This is the Bereishis series, and today is January 21st. Yesterday, on page 69, I pointed out to you that verse 13, which says, "Know with certainty that your offspring shall be aliens in a land not their own. They will serve them, they will oppress them 400 years. That the 400 years is ambiguous. It's the structure of the verse is A, B, C, 400 years. So it could be read A, B, comma, and C for 400 years. Or it could be read A, comma, B and C for 400 years. Or it could be read A, B, C for 400 years. And that gave three different possibilities for when the end of the period would take place. And although it's three out of thousands that are excluded, so it's not a content-less prediction, but it does leave open different possibilities. Now, I mentioned that this is not the only instance. If you take a look in the art scroll, Megillas Esther, they record the history prior to the building of the Second Temple during the Babylonian exile. Jeremiah said the Babylonian exile will last 70 years. He just omitted to determine when the 70 years start, which means that it's not exactly clear when they end. And there were, in fact, a number of events which would be reasonable candidates for when it should start. And there were people who made mistakes. Belshazzar made a mistake, thought it was over, and prophecy was not going to come true, and therefore took out the vessels of the temple to use at a feast, and he was assassinated that evening. So it was the received opinion that something went wrong, and they put the vessels of the temple back into the storehouses. The Megillas Esther opens with Ahasuerus' party. What was he celebrating? He also had a calculation as to when the 70 years should be over, and he was celebrating the fact that the Jews are not going to be redeemed. He also made a mistake. So the prediction of Jeremiah that the Babylonian exile would be 70 years is one which also has this kind of ambiguity built in. It's not exactly clear when the starting date should be, but that doesn't mean it has no content. Had 300 years gone on from the destruction of the temple and the exile of the people, so everybody would have known that it came out false. Not as if it had no content, but it had several possibilities, and they, both of them, made mistakes about it. Now, as was pointed out yesterday, and I just mentioned it to you, let's look at the exact phraseology in this sentence, 13. Know with certainty that your offspring shall be aliens in a land not their own. At this point, we have mentioned two subjects. Your offspring is one, and the land not their own means it's going to belong to somebody else. So it's your offspring and some people X. They will serve them. Who will serve who? Your offspring will serve X. They will oppress them. Who will oppress who? X will oppress your offspring. So the they isn't consistent. In the prior clause, the they refers to the offspring. In the next clause, the they refers to the people in whose midst they're living who will oppress your offspring. Okay, from the context, it's quite clear what the verse wants. And this is typical. The Torah expects the reader to be intelligent and critical and take into account the context and the message. It does not spell out every detail. We'll see this over and over again, where the Torah will take it for granted. Sometimes in fairly obvious cases, A will say to B, "Didn't I tell you X?" But nowhere in the prior discussion of the story does it say he told him X. Well, of course, if A says to B, "Didn't I tell you X?" And B doesn't protest, "No, you didn't. Are you crazy? Are you hallucinating?" Obviously, he did tell it to him. Either Torah didn't tell it because it knows that when you hear this conversation, you'll be able to infer that he did tell him X on a prior occasion. And that's all you need. The Torah will do this over and over again. It's true if you read it in an extremely simple-minded frame of mind, useful, let's say, for the New York Times, then you might think of it as a glitch in the text. Once you appreciate that it's being written for people who are going to think and analyze and draw implications, then it shouldn't be a problem. Yeah.
Just one question on the sentence. Why does it say aliens in a land not their own? Isn't that saying the same thing pretty much twice?
You're right. In English it does, but it doesn't have to mean that. Ger means a temporary resident. It's as opposed to a toshav. A toshav is a permanent resident. And it could be that you will own a piece of land and live there for a while and then move on to another piece of land which you will own. You don't have to be in a land belonging to somebody else in order to be a ger in a particular place. But that's a good point. I mean, in the English, you don't see that. Okay, I can't explain the content of the event of the covenant, so I'm going to skip it. Page 71. Here I can take you through it in detail and at least give you some understanding. Let me read you through the basic story, and then we'll go back and take it apart piece by piece. There's a great deal here in the details. Sarai, Avram's wife, had bore him no children. She had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. Sarai said to Avram, "See now, Hashem has restrained me from bearing. Consort thou with my maidservant, perhaps I will be built up through her." And Avram heeded the voice of Sarai. So Sarai, Avram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her maidservant, after 10 years of Avram's dwelling in the land of Canaan, and gave her to Avram, her husband, to him as a wife. He consorted with Hagar, she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived,
When
Hagar saw that she, Hagar herself, had conceived, her mistress, whose mistress? Hagar's mistress, was lowered in her esteem. Who's her?
Hagar.
So all the pronouns here refer to Hagar. So Sarai said to Avram, "The outrage against me is due to you. It is I who gave my maidservant into your bosom, and now as she sees that she is conceived, I became lowered in her esteem. Let Hashem judge between me and you." Avram said to Sarai, "Behold, your maidservant is in your hand. Do to her as you see fit." Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. Okay, let's go over that in detail. Sarai, Avram's wife, had borne him no children. Don't we know that she's Avram's wife? We've known that for a few chapters already. Why would the Torah bother telling me that she's Avram's wife here?
To show that Abraham, even though she didn't bring him any children, he still, was his number one wife.
Okay, you're one step ahead of me. I didn't ask the question clearly enough. But you have the right idea. If the Torah mentions that she's Avram's wife, that's got to be important for this story. One has to see that her being his wife motivates the story. It somehow generates the story. Now, he did that one way. It means to tell you that she remains in that position even though she hasn't borne him children. It would be one way to answer the question. But one has to appreciate when the Torah says A happened, and B happened, and C happened, and D happened, so it means that A was the reason for B, or the background for B, or the possibility of B. It's not just a list of disconnected events. Here it says Avram, Sarah's wife. You know, you could have mentioned her father, you could have mentioned her sister, you could have left it out altogether, as it does in other places. Here it means it's because he's his wife that she's his wife that somehow the story takes place. Now, here it's fairly, one explanation is fairly transparent. She's concerned that he should have children. And she's willing to allow another woman to function as his wife in order that he should have children. That's a symptom of her dedication to him. She's doing this as his wife, as someone who loves him and cares for him and says, I have not given you children. I don't think you have to live with my disability. Of course, we could ask, what question? Okay, a little logic. How does she know that it's her problem? They haven't had children. I mean, right? This is where Ishmael is going to be born, so he hasn't had any children. That's a good question to think about, right? Okay. She had an Egyptian maidservant, his name was Hagar. Sorry, said to Avram, see now his strength has restrained me from bearing. What does that imply? How else could it have been said? Instead of restrained me from bearing, she could have said,
not allowed me to bear.
Or even more,
has not borne me.
In other words, has not given me children. What would be the difference between saying he's restrained me from bearing versus he has not given me children?
Whose hands is it in?
In both cases, it's in God's hands. If you say he restrained her, or if you say he didn't give her, it's both in his hands.
Restrained means that at one time it was possible, or in the future it will be possible.
Oh, what is the implication for the default position? What's the default position? If you say he's restrained me, then the default position is, I should have had children. That would have been natural and expected. And he stopped it. Whereas if you say he didn't give me, that doesn't imply that you should have children or you shouldn't have children. It's just, you know, they come from God and he didn't give them. Here she's indicating that by rights, by the kinds of considerations that would have been natural, she should have had children. And he stopped her. Her phraseology here is very indicative. As we'll see. Okay? Yeah.
That answers the question, how'd she know it was her?
No. How does she know that God hasn't restrained him from bearing?
She says, restrain me.
Okay. Suppose she said, God has not given me children. Wouldn't she also be pointing the finger at herself?
Yeah.
So either way, that's not the point that's indicated by the difference between saying restrained me and saying didn't give me. That's the point that I'm making at the moment. Okay. Consort not with my maidservant. Perhaps I will be built up through her. What could she mean by that? Perhaps I will be built up through her.
Since Avram's going to have children, it's going to elevate her too.
In what way elevate her?
The whole idea with if, like, someone's barren and they adopt kids or whatever, there's kids around, then chances are they'll have kids too.
Okay, this is crucial now. What you're saying is what I believe is correct. There are people who suggest another explanation. The being built up through her means I too will have children. That means to be built up. In fact, the Maharal points out that the word ben in Hebrew, which means either son or offspring, can be in general terms we use for daughters as well, ben comes from the verb bana, which means to build. And as we'll see in a later incident, the word ben can be used very selectively. And not all of your biological offspring have to be called ben. We'll see that in detail in Yisrael Hashem. So when she says I bone, using that verb, I'll be built up, she's using the word ben. Someone once suggested to me it just means you'll have a lot of merit by providing this for Avram. I don't think that's right. That doesn't mean that she'll be built up. The word built up is related to the word ben, and she's talking about, now, why should it happen? So he says, we know even in natural terms, people who suffer from infertility, if they adopt children, often that's the trigger. Nobody knows exactly why that is. Infertility is a big unknown in medical research. So she could simply say, she'll have a child, and the child will be in the house, and I'll participate in raising the child. And through that, I'll also have a child. Or she could mean, in the merit of my providing you with a child, which you as my husband deserve, and not holding you back from it, in that merit, God will bless me with a child as well. Either way, but the I will be built up means that I too will have a child. Avram heeded the voice of Sarai. Okay, now here you have this artificial English. What does it mean to heed someone's voice?
Follow the instructions.
It means to obey. It means to obey. Follow the instructions. In Hebrew, it's l'shmoa bikol. L'shmoa bikol is not l'shmoa likol or eskol or kol. L'shmoa bikol means to obey. What do you make of the fact that the Torah describes Abraham's action here as obeying Sarah's voice?
Almost unwilling.
Say again?
Almost unwilling. He didn't really want
to. Okay, it's not coming from him. It's not coming from him. She said so. And he's doing it because she said so. What does it tell you about Abraham, about the situation here?
He doesn't want to sleep with another woman.
He doesn't want to have another wife, even though, what? Even though he has no children. He has no children. And she's so concerned about the fact that he has no children, she wants to provide him with the opportunity to have children through another woman. He's so concerned about her and about the general circumstances that he doesn't want to have another wife. Okay, she said so. Out of deference to her, he'll do it. This is typical. This is typical. Polygamy, with only one exception, polygamy is the exception. And in our circumstances, it's never initiated by the husband. It's only initiated by the wives because of the problem of children. And indeed, there's an incident in the Talmud, which I came across recently, during the Daf Yomi, which indicates this. By the way, there isn't a single case, I don't believe, in the entire Talmud where we know of a man who had more than one wife.
How about with the kings?
That's an exception. The exception is with the kings. That's explicitly stated only for the kings, and in the entire Talmud, covering 450 years, with the hundreds of people who I mentioned, not one do we know had more than one wife. Not one. And the Gemara tells the following story. In times of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the end of the Mishnah, it was customary when a man got married that there was a contract with the in-laws, with the wife's family, and with the wife, that he should go to learn for a period of time before the marriage was consummated and they set up household. And they would contract for a certain number of years. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi had a son, and they made Kiddushin, and the contract was for 12 years. 12 years went by. At the end of 12 years, when he was going to come back to marry her, she had become barren. She had become infertile. What to do? So Rabbi Yehuda Nasi says, what shall I do? Have him divorce her? Then they'll say, look, she waited for him for 12 years and this was her reward. Have him marry another woman? Now listen carefully. Have him marry another woman together with her? Then they'll say, this one is his wife and this one is his prostitute. Which is which? It means the first one, who's barren, is his wife. She's the one that he chose. And the second one that he took to have children with is his prostitute. And therefore, Rebbe said, neither of those are acceptable solutions. And he prayed, and she was cured. Look at the attitude. Look at the attitude. A man who takes a second wife is equivalent to taking a prostitute. Clearly, the attitude towards polygamy was very negative. Now, there were times when it was necessary. The Medrash, someone pointed out, when I discussed this with another Talmud Chacham, he said to me, the Medrash says at the beginning of the book of Shmuel that Elkanah had two wives, Penina and Chana, only because Chana had no children. So he took another wife, same thing, but only for that reason. Not because he wanted to have a harem. So here you could see at least part of Avram's reluctance. We don't do that. We don't do that. But she wants it out of concern for me. She wants it out of concern for me. I'm doing it because she wants it. The relationship that you see here between Abraham and Sarah is really exquisite. Okay, we're all together? Now it says, Sarai, Abraham's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her maidservant, after 10 years of Abraham's dwelling in the land of Canaan. Why do I care about that? that's got to be relevant to the story. No details are put in that aren't relevant to the story. From here, a very famous halacha is derived, and that is, when can a man say that my wife and I are not having children and it's time for me to try elsewhere, either marrying another wife, or if you're Ashkenazi in our times, divorcing a wife, getting another, when is it time that he has to consider this? After 10 years. But, according to what the verse says explicitly, what limitation would you put on that? After 10 years?
Living in the same place.
No, more than that. It says more than that. Yes, that's close to what he said, but it says more than that. You're leaving out some of the words. Old, huh?
Israel?
Living in Israel. After 10 years of living in the land of Canaan, that's when she did it. Say the commentators, if you're living in New York, it doesn't count. Because maybe the discredit of living in New York is what prevented you from having children. You can't pin it on the relationship between the two people. Only if you lived in Eretz Yisrael for 10 years. Then you could say that it has to do with the relationship between the people. And then he should try because he has a mitzvah of procreation. Okay. Gave her to her husband, to him as a wife. In other words, this isn't a purely biological interaction and a fly-by-night matter, and just when one woman it's not a surrogate mother over here. He's giving it to her as a wife. He's going to live with her. He's going to live with her and treat her as a wife. He consorted with Hagar, and she conceived. It's going to be very important in two verses. And when she saw that she had conceived, when Hagar saw that she, Hagar, had conceived, Hagar's mistress, who's Hagar's mistress? Sarah, right? Sarah was lowered in her esteem. Why would that be? Why would that be? Number one, we now know that the infertility was due to Sarah. At least Hagar knows. Somehow Sarah knew that before, but Hagar knows now that it's due to Sarah. Okay, there is infertility in the world, you know? Not everybody can have children. Why would she be lowered in her esteem thereby? Okay, fertility is a divine gift, and God isn't favoring her. But it's much more than that. Avram and Sarah converted thousands of people. And they presented themselves to the world as God's chosen, and representing a way of life that brings people close to God. And now, she is barren? Says Hagar, then something's rotten in there. She looks very nice on the outside, but on the inside she's rotten. Because if she really were what she claims to be, then God would have given her children. And therefore, she says, she's a phony. She's a phony. And this perception, though it's wrong, as we will see, this perception could help explain why Sarah said, God has restrained me from bearing. Because the natural assumption is, if you're representing God in the world and making sacrifices and undertaking dangers and so on and so on, that God should show through you how he relates to people who are representing him in the world. And fertility is one of the key successes in life. And they don't have it. So she says, look, if I look at the record, I would have expected to be favored with children. Didn't happen. I can't conclude from that something wrong with me, but it definitely would have been expected from the record. As a matter of fact, the Gemara tells us that all the matriarchs and all the patriarchs were barren, all seven of them. Though it's not indicated in the verses directly, all of them were barren. And in every case, fertility required the equivalent of a miracle. And that's the message that was being introduced here. That when it happened to the patriarchs, it was not through their own. It was a miracle which took them out of the normal pattern of events. That's the message that was. But these are the beginning. These are the first two patriarchs. It wasn't clear yet. Indeed, the fact that Leah had children right away, the Torah says God saw that Leah was disfavored and opened her womb. In other words, had he not done that, she also would have been closed. All of them are supposed to be closed, unless, you know, until a special divine favor, a special divine action. Okay, so Hagar says Sarah is a phony. She doesn't deserve the kind of position that she's taking, because I see that it's the failure to have children was her fault and not Avram's. Sarai said to Avram, there's no so in the Hebrew, the outrage against me is due to you. It was I who gave my marriage into your bosom, and now she sees that she has conceived. I became lower in her esteem. Let Hashem judge between me and you. What has Sarah got against Avram here? Why is she complaining to Avram? And then the answer is very simple. Hagar is making a mistake. She doesn't know how to read divine actions and divine intentions. Avram should have prepared her for this. Avram should have told her, L'chatchila, listen, if you become pregnant, don't think it's because you're greater than Sarah. No, that's not the situation. God doesn't deal with the world in this way. Says Sarah, you should have protected me from this. And if she has come up with this conclusion, it's your failure. You haven't acted on my behalf. Which, as you can imagine, if Sarah went out of the way to give another woman to her husband in order to provide with children, and he doesn't anticipate this problem and prevent it, she's upset. Okay, I just mentioned, I'm not going to stress it, but when she says, let Hashem judge between me and you, that's a statement that Chazal say is too strong, and she suffered for it. Okay, Aaron says to Sarai, behold, your maidservant is in your hand. What do you see in those words? Compare them with
why is it your maidservant?
Rather than
maidservant?
Say again?
It's Sarai's maidservant.
Rather than
Avram's maidservant. So the only thing.
Okay, the servants were often assigned to the husband or the wife as their main duties. And when Rachel and Leah get married, Lavan gives each one a maidservant for her. And the maidservant had designated duties. What did we stress in 3? Oh. It says, Sarai gave Hagar to Avram as a wife. So what is Avram saying to Sarai? I'm living with her as a wife. I'm treating her that way. That's right. We don't live with women in a trivial way. But in my eyes, she's still your maidservant. She still belongs to you. And therefore, you're in control. Do with her as you please. Although, I want to read in here, I haven't found anybody who's prepared to agree with me. I didn't see it in the commentaries. But he says, the English doesn't say so. But the Hebrew does. The English says, do as you see fit. In the Hebrew, it's do to her what is good in your eyes. Asila hatov beinayich. I hear a hint here. Okay, I'm giving you control, and you have to discipline her and so on, but do something that's good. Do something that's good. Okay, good for her, and discipline, all the rest. Let it be something that's good in your eyes to do. I think he's hinting to her here to have some forbearance, some mercy in the thing. Okay, I'm just telling you how it sounds to me. And Sarai dealt harshly with her, so she fled from her. Who fled from who?
Hagar
fled from Sarai. Yeah.
Before it said that Sarah is blaming it on Avram.
Right.
And now she's punishing Hagar.
Well. It's like this, you know, parents who are irresponsible in raising their child and the child turns out to be a thief. You're still going to imprison the child who steals, aren't you? He stole. You just say to the parents, you know why he turned out like that? Because you didn't take measures X, Y, Z, which could have prevented it. That doesn't mean that the child became a robot and has no responsibility for what he's doing, right? So, and she's saying, I've got to punish Avram, so. No, but sorry, Hagar has to be taught that her response, number one, her judgment was a mistake, and number two, even if she had a private judgment, her position is a position of a servant who can't take those airs. Okay, now comes a fascinating and a lot of implications in the next few events. So Hagar flees from the house. An angel of Hashem found her by the spring of the water in the desert at the spring of the road to Shur, and he said, Hagar, maidservant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? What do you see in this verse?
She's still her maidservant.
She's run away. She's run away. The angel says to her, don't kid yourself. You are Sarai's maidservant. That's what you are. Maybe you ran out of the house, okay, but that's your identity. You're not getting away with that. You're not losing out from that. Now, she said, I'm running away from my mistress. She agrees. I don't think she's learning something from the angel that she has to reconsider. She said, I know who I am. I know what I am. I just can't take it. I can't stand it. But I know that I'm homeless. I'm without a context. I'm not looking to go back to Egypt, which is where she's from. No, I know what I am. I just can't stand it. Yeah.
I just want to ask, do angels, are angels sent from anybody besides Hashem?
No.
So why does it mention an angel of Hashem?
Oh, because, you're right to ask, because the word in Hebrew isn't angel. The word in Hebrew is malach, and malach means messenger. And a human being can be a malach. Doesn't have to be. So malach Hashem means as a messenger that God sent. In English, the word angel covers both. You're right. In English, it's ambiguous, but it's redundant. But in the Hebrew, it's not redundant. Okay. So an angel found her and asked, and she answered, right? 9. And an angel of Hashem said to her, what do you infer? Say again?
Again, mention the angel of God.
Well, okay, I mean, that's the artifact of the English. But okay. Who was talking in 7?
Sorry. Hagar.
7?
7.
Well, okay, right. Yeah. An angel of Hashem found her, and he said, right? Yeah. 9 says, and an angel of Hashem said. So what do you infer?
Different angel.
It's a different angel. It doesn't say, and he said. It's a different angel and a different speech. Right? It's a different angel. Good. He said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself to her domination. 10. And an angel of Hashem said to her, meaning another angel, another speech, without any answer in between. We don't have on record what she said. So as we have pointed out before, and we'll point this out many times, there's got to be a reason why it's two separate speeches, and there's got to be a reason to understand what happened in between that the text is sort of hoping you'll figure out on your own to explain why you go from speech to speech instead of having one long speech. 10, an angel of Hashem said to her, I will greatly increase your offspring, and they will not be counted for abundance. Blank! 11, and an angel of Hashem said to her, this is number 4, you know, there's like a parade of angels, one after the other. Said to her, behold, you will conceive and give birth to a son, call his name Ishmael, Hashem has heard your prayer, etc., etc.
Are these three different angels, three different appearances?
I mean, if it's different angels, it can't be, I mean, one disappears and the next one appears, and instead of coming as a quartet, yes, I understand it that way. One appears and disappears, the second one appears and disappears, third one appears and disappears, fourth one, there are 4 here, right? Okay, the text doesn't. I'm trying to stay as close to the text as I can. All right. Now, do you see something peculiar in 11? Okay, if you compare 11 to 10, 10 says she's going to have a great offspring, and 11 says you're going to conceive, That seems to be included in 10. You're right to point that out, but isn't it worse than that?
She should have already conceived if she hangs with Avram.
Why was she running away? Because she's pregnant, right? And because she was pregnant, she was treating Sarah without the appropriate respect, and Sarah responded by oppressing her, and she ran away. How could the angel in 11 say, you will conceive? Okay. One baby step on the basis of logic. Could you possibly think of a scenario in which this statement at 11 is appropriate, even though in verse 6 she's pregnant?
Depends how many months pass.
How about a miscarriage? You will conceive means you're not pregnant. Otherwise, you could talk about the pregnancy that she has, right? It means that Sarai's punishment of her, punishing her, was so severe that she lost the baby. And that's why she's running away. She's not just running away because it's long hours scrubbing the floor, or because Sarai subjects her to criticism and ridicule. She lost the baby. So she says, I can't stand it. I just can't manage it. Now, with that piece of information, let's go through the speeches one by one and see if we can't infer, with not too much difficulty, Hagar's unspoken response that motivates speech after speech after speech. 9. The angel says, return to your mistress and submit yourself to her domination. What's Hagar's response? Not on your life. Not on your life. I have no future there. I can't take it there. I'm lost there. 10, the angel says, I'll greatly increase your offspring and they will not be counted for abundance. What's Hagar's response? I saw that won't work. Is that true? I had a child and I lost a child. You're promising me children, so I won't permit it. 11, angel says, behold, you will conceive and give birth to a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, for Hashem has heard your prayer, and he shall be a wild ass of a man, his hand against everyone, everyone's hand against him, and over all his brothers he shall dwell. Okay, you tell me I'm going to conceive. I'm going to have a son. You tell me what name to give him, and tell me what his future will be. I hear that as a commitment. I hear that as a commitment. And that she accepts, and she goes back. Once she understands she lost the child, the speeches, as separate speeches, and the inferred responses in between are tolerably clear. One more remark before I take your question. Just want to point, the commentators point out here. She sees an angel. Any particular response? Does she prostrate herself? Does she run away in fright? Does she, hello, how are you today? She's nonplussed. Angel tells her something and she responds, no. Say the commentators, she was very used to angels. Angels were very common in Abraham's house, and she was used to them. Seeing an angel was not a big deal for her. Well, look what we're talking about. We're talking about somebody who's not a small person. Seeing an angel was not a big deal for her. Yeah, okay, the angel, very good, you know. Tell me to do something. I have my own opinion on the subject, and I can answer you back and say, no, it's not true. Right? She was she was not overwhelmed by seeing angels and interacting with them. Yeah.
Did Sarah mean to kill the baby?
I don't know. I don't know whether that was Sarah's intention or whether it happened as a byproduct. I really don't know. I don't know of any sort, but of course, the sources could be in the Midrash. I don't learn Midrash. So when I quote a Midrash to you, it's only because one out of 10,000, which I happen to know. But I don't learn it regularly. There may be something there that I'm not aware of. I really don't know. It's a good question. It's a reasonable question. Okay. And indeed, Ishmael was born. Okay, now, chapter 17 is also a long and interesting and coordinated set of ideas. I'll just introduce one idea to you, and then we'll pick it up tomorrow.
I don't want to understand that she just went back to the house, and then Avram just was with her again after Sarah did what she did.
Well, the whole point of it was that he should have children. If they lost this one, you know, this question trying again.
Yeah,
Sarah
got so upset that that Hagar law that her level was lowered in Hagar's view. So how is she just suddenly okay with that?
Well, my guess is I don't know any sources on it, but my guess is that Hagar changed her behavior. She got the point and realized that the fact that Sarah didn't have children doesn't mean anything about her spiritual status. Indeed, it could mean the opposite.
That could be the case. I'm just wondering why it just goes right into it, you know? It doesn't make any mention.
It doesn't make any mention, but if you know what the problem was, then you see that it didn't continue, so then it's fair to infer that the problem went away. Here we have the parsha that talks about names. There's a great deal about names. Names are very important in the Tanakh. Tomorrow I'll take you through the context, but right now I just want to look at two verses and compare and contrast them to get one point out, and then tomorrow we'll do it again and get the context. Verse 5. Hashem says to Avram, your name shall no longer be called Avram. Your name shall be Avraham, for I have made you the father of multitude of nations. That's his name. Hey, look at verse 15. God said to Avram, as for Sarai, your wife, do not call her name Sarai, for Sarah is her name. Do you see a fundamental difference in the treatment of the names between 5 and 15? There's a fundamental difference in the way the names are treated. What's happening to the names? What's going on with the names between 5 and 15?
A hey is added.
Okay, that's true in terms of the orthography. The spelling, it's going to... But I'm talking about what's going on with the names. What's happening with the names.
Standing. So Avraham's name is because he's become a multitude, a father of a multitude of nations. And Sarah's.
Okay, 5, there's a reason given. In 15, not... In 16, it says that she'll be the mother of a multitude of nations. That's not what I'm looking for. Not the reason for it, but what happens. Not why it happens, but what happens.
Avram's name is being changed. Sarah's name is being... they say that you should call her Sarah, you should call him Avram because of this given reason. And the other one is, do not call her name Sarai because her name is Sarai.
So you had it, let's just say it clearly. His name is being changed and her name?
I can't put the name on the verb for it.
Oh, you do? It's part of your vocabulary. His name is being changed and her name is being revealed. No, it's not being changed. It's not being changed. That's the crucial difference. In his case, it says your name was Avram, not anymore. From now on, you're going to have a different name. Avraham. That's a change of name. In her case, it says don't call the name Sarai, for Sarah is her name. That is her name. I'm not changing it to something new. Okay, you've been calling her Sarai all these years. Okay, that's your problem. As you'll see, there's a reason for that. But that's not her name. Her name is Sarah. It's a gigantic difference. In the case of Jacob, as we will see, a name is added. So you have a change of name, a revelation of a name, an addition of a name. Someone who doesn't get the differences between those three incidents in this respect can begin to understand what's going on. Yeah.
Also, when... first one, God's telling Avram his name. The second one, God's telling Avram Sarah's name.
Yes, he does. Telling Avram how to call Sarah, right? Instead of telling, whatever the contrast would be. Correct.
Sarah already
in there? Yeah. I don't know, but that's it. Okay, we'll talk about it tomorrow.
Thank you.
You're welcome.